Good morning, everyone. This is probably not going to be the best recording in the world, or because I've had a scratchy throat now for over a week and I just can't seem to get rid of it. But we'll do the best we can. The title of my message this morning is The Bottom Line. When you go shopping for a car and you finally picked out what you want, you start to wheel and deal with the seller. I never pay full price. I always dicker that as use unless the price is already so low that you can't beat it. But what I am always interested in is the bottom line of what I'm going to pay for that car. The out-the-door price, you know, it's easy when you go to buy something, even a set of tires, you know, okay, it's $65 a tire. And you say 65 times 4 is 260, but you find out the bottom line price when you go to pay for it is a lot more because you got the balancing, the warranties on the tires, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you end up paying a lot more. I want to know what it is out the door. And so that's what I am going to preach about in the teachings of Jesus, the bottom line. Turn with me, if you will, to Matthew 24, verse 6 to 8. Now this is sort of where we're at today in this world, and you will hear wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nations will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdoms. There will be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. You know, we have been talking about this for years. We see more and more around us, but let's not use this as the total sign of Jesus' soon return, because, you know, the Lisbon earthquake, the worst earthquake that ever was considered to be the worst. They didn't have Richter scales back then. It was in 1755. The greatest hurricane hit Galveston, Texas in 1900. Now, I could go along down a long list of natural disasters and significant world events and preach a message, a stirring message, to rouse you to action about Christ's coming as imminent. So you better bunker down and get ready. How many times have we heard this before? It seems like too often in our experience, we camp around the valley of the shadow of doom and gloom. I think it's long past time to pull up stakes and move to what I believe Jesus is telling us. For too long, we have tried to sometimes chart last day events, trying to figure right down to when's Jesus going to come, set dates. And this happens a lot. I can think of Harold Camping. Remember, he had a date that he set that Christ was going to come. Interesting, it was October 22, I think, 2011 or 2012. Then he moved it forward. And also, sometimes we think if we could just stop getting over this sin problem, that Jesus would come. We need more time. And I think we've allowed too much of this to focus our attention in the approaching storm, and with literal fear and trembling, we dive into all kinds of speculation. Well, do I need to elaborate? For too long, I think we have let our last day events charts eclipse the teachings of Jesus, who tells us really what he is wanting to see in his people, the bottom line. So let's move on. So here in chapters 24 and 25, Jesus is talking to his disciples. The two chapters go together. In chapter 25, he tells three parables, each about the kingdom of heaven. In the first verse of Matthew 25, he says, the kingdom of heaven is like 10 virgins, and he tells a familiar parable that we all know. That really should take a separate message, because there is a bottom line to that message, leading up to the grand bottom line that is at the end of the parable. Then he goes on with another parable about a master who goes into a far country and he leaves various amounts of money to his servants. And he calls for an accountability when he comes. I think we sort of discussed this in the Sabbath school class this morning of what Jesus expects from us in how we invest our time, our resources, our talents, everything we've got. Are we investing it in the future for souls, for the kingdom of heaven, or are we just doing in the here, living in the here and now and not worried about what the future holds in the broader scheme of things? And of course, this sermon could be preached about that too, but I got to move on to what the crux of my sermon is about this morning. Because Matthew 25 culminates with the last parable that Jesus tells in that chapter. In fact, if you look, that is the in the book of Matthew, that is the last of Jesus' parables in a series of parables through the whole book. Jesus is always trying to teach a heavenly lesson in those parables, and he connects it with things of everyday life that people of that time could understand, because he had a moral of a story he was trying to teach, something beyond just the here and now of what is he trying to do, what's he wanting from his people. All those people who claim his name on the face of this earth. So here, Matthew 25, verse 31, through to the end of the chapter, is the last parable that Jesus tells in his ministry here on earth in the book of Matthew. The rest of the book tells about the events leading up to his crucifixion, the resurrection, and then on to the gospel commission given at the end of the chapter, the book of Matthew, to go into all the world to preach the great everlasting gospel of Jesus Christ. So it's simply cause to reason that the last parable is the bottom line. Let's turn to Matthew 25. Let's look at the first two verses. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels will come, then he will sit on the throne of glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from his goats. Now shepherds often separated sheep and goats at night. Sheep were more valuable of the two. They also tolerated cold nights much better, and they were usually associated with good things. Goats, on the other hand, were less valuable, needed to huddle together to keep warm on cold nights, and they were usually associated with trouble. They were troublemakers. So Jesus is talking about what separates the lost from the saved at the second coming, because he talks here, when the Son of Man comes. So he's talking about his second coming. So let's read the rest of Matthew 21. Starting with the 33rd verse. Did I say Matthew 20? I meant Matthew 25. And he will set the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say unto them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you have done it to one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. Then he will also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Sick, and you did not clothe me. naked and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison and you did not visit me. Then they will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you in hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly, I say unto you, inasmuch as you did not do it unto one of the least of these, you did not do it unto me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Randy Roberts, the pastor of Loma Linda University, the senior pastor, tells a story about how when he was going to college, he, his brother, and his sister rented a house outside of the town where they were going to college. And one night he was coming home on a very foggy, drippy night. You know how those are, you don't necessarily see real well. I've gotten to the point I can't even drive at night when it's raining. My eyesight just doesn't work very well. Anyway, he was driving along and he saw somebody along the side of the road running. And he just thought, that's kind of strange. Why would somebody be out jogging on a night like this? So, oh well, to each his own. So he went right on past and got to home. About a half an hour later, his brother burst in the door. He says, what is it with it, man? I'm broke down and I'm trying to run to get home and you whiz right on past me. And Randy, to his shock, said, oh, I didn't know it was you. I thought it was just somebody out jogging. If I had known it was you, I would have stopped and picked you up. There's a story I heard long ago, and I used it in a sermon some 20 years ago, about a young man who came home from the Vietnam War. He called his mother from California. She lived in Boston, and the family was part of the really high-class jet set of the Boston cocktail circuit crowd. And he called home from a payphone, and he asked, I have a friend I want to bring home. And his mother said, well, go ahead and bring him. She says, well, Mom, I need to tell you something about this friend. He had an accident during the war. He stepped on a landmine. And he has an arm missing, a leg missing, one eye is gone, and his face is rather mangled. There's a pause on the other end of the line, and she said, well, go ahead and bring him home for a few days. I guess it'd be all right. Then he said, Mom, you don't understand. I want to bring him home to live with us. And then the mother starts throwing up all kinds of excuses, saying, well, I don't know how that would work. I mean, what do you think? How would this young man feel around our friends? Yeah, she was really thinking, what are my friends going to think of this guy? And she goes on and on with all kinds of excuses. And suddenly, the line went dead. He'd hung up. Several hours later, the police called his home. There was some identification in the wallet. And asked for Mrs. So-and-so, who answered the phone. This was the boy's mother. And he said, we have a young man that we found tonight who had one leg missing, an arm missing, a mangled face, and his identification indicates that he is your son. One wonders if it had made any difference. Would the conversation have reached a different conclusion? Would the young man's life have been a different end had she known that he was a mangled veteran? In terms of the parable, it didn't really matter. Jesus said we are judged based on our response to him. And since he is disguised in the appearance of human need, our response to the needs around us reveals the true character of the heart. Thus, for those on the left, the goats, the true attitude of the heart was they didn't care. That was their bottom line. So the first surprise is the surprise of the lost. They say, we didn't know that it was you. If we had known it was you, we have done something. Oh, really? There's a story of a little boy in Chicago. This was years ago. I can't remember just where I heard it, but I did hear it, and it was a true story. And he was trying to sell newspapers, and it was a very cold night in old Chicago. And people were coming in and out of the stores, and he was on the corner, as little newsboys did in those days, and the snow and a blizzard was about to set in, and he was just so cold. And so he walked up to a policeman and tugged on his shoulder and his coat and said, sir, you wouldn't know where a cold boy could spend a night, do you? He says, it's so cold. He says, you know, I live in a box down here, down the street in an alley, and it's going to be so cold in that box. I need something warm place to get in out of this storm. And the police officer said, well, you know, you go up the street a few blocks, and there's a house with a white picket fence around it, and there's a stairway, and it goes up to a big old two-story house. You walk up to that house, and you knock on the door, and when somebody comes to that door, you just say John 3:16. Little boy was so cold that he ran as fast as he could. He opened the gate, he ran up the steps, he climbed up to the front porch, he went across the front porch, he banged on the door, and after a while the door opened just ever so slightly, and the little boy says, John 3:16, and it opened wide, and he says, well, come right on in. And a little old lady brought him into the parlor where a nice crackling warm fire was going. He'd got in out of the cold. And he thought to himself, John 3:16. I don't know what it means, but it sure makes a cold boy warm. And he could smell something cooking, some food. After a while, she came out in the kitchen and asked him if he was hungry. He said, well, yeah, I guess I'm a little hungry. Boy hadn't eaten for ages, a good meal. So he comes into the kitchen, and here is this table fit for a king of all his delicious food. And he ate, and he ate, and he ate. And as he ate, he thought, John 3:16. I don't know what it means, but it sure makes a hungry boy feel full. Then she led him upstairs to a bathroom where there was a nice hot bath she'd drawn. And she said, would you like a bath? Would he like a bath? He hadn't had a whole bath in years. This kid was living on the streets. And so he jumped in the bathtub, and he soaked, and he soaked, and he soaked. And as he soaked, he thought, John 3:16, I don't know what it means, but it sure makes a dirty boy feel clean. And then he noticed some pajamas on a stool. So he put those pajamas on, oh, nice warm pajamas. Man, he hadn't had pajamas in his life. And then he came out, and she led him to a bedroom, opened the door. And then there was a bed, a canopy bed, you know, most time on top, back in the old days. And it had a feather bed comforter on. He jumped on that thing, and he got into bed, and just, oh, my, this feels, he'd never slept in a bed like this before. And she pulled the covers up under his chin and gave him a kiss. Good night. So he sat there, and the storm was really coming in strong. He could hear the wind blowing and howling. And he said to himself, John 3:16, I don't know what it means, but it sure makes a cold boy feel safe and warm. A homeless boy. He got up the next morning, and my, this is interesting. There was some clean clothes. And it was a coat, a brand new coat with wool lining and everything. And he put that coat on. Oh, he felt so warm and cozy. That threadbare thing he had couldn't keep the wind out. And he comes downstairs and he smells something cooking. And here is another big feast of food. And he sits down there and eats. And then afterwards, the lady takes him back into the parlor. And she said, would you like to know about John 16? He said, 3:16. And he says, well, you know, I'd never heard of it before. I thought it was an address or something. She said, would you like to know about John 3:16? She sat down and told him about the love of Jesus. little boy gave his heart to the Lord, had a lasting impact. Another story. So I guess the most touching part of the parable is the surprise of the righteous. They thought they were just caring for common people, ordinary people, people who all too easily are soon forgotten. In 1921, Lewis Laws became the warden of Sing Sing Prison. During that time, no prison was tougher than Sing Sing. But by the time Warden Laws retired some 20 years later, the prison had become a much more humanitarian institution. Those who studied the system gave credit for the change to Laws, but when he was asked about the transformation, he said simply, "I owe it all to my wonderful wife, Catherine." You see, when Laws became the warden, Catherine was a young mother with three small children. Here they were, within the reach of the most dreaded prison of the day. Everybody warned her from the beginning that she would never set foot inside the prison walls. But Catherine decided otherwise. She would become a part of the life of those who were in prison. Her attitude was, "My husband and I are going to take care of those men, and I believe they will take care of us. I don't have a thing to worry." Imagine that. Would you have that kind of faith today? When the first prison basketball game was held, she walked into the game with her three beautiful kids and actually sat in the stands with the inmates. She insisted on getting to know each one of them, and she discovered that one convicted murderer was blind. So she paid him a visit, holding his hand in hers, and said, "Do you read Braille?" "What's Braille?" he asked. And over a period of time, she answered his question by teaching him how to read. Sometime later, Catherine learned a prisoner was deaf. She went to school and learned how to use sign language in order to communicate with him. Many prisoners and others said that Catherine Lewis was the body of Jesus that came alive in Sing Sing from 1921 to 1937. Then tragedy struck. Catherine Laws was killed in an automobile accident. The morning after her death, Lewis Laws didn't come to work that day. His second in command took his place. It seemed like almost instantly the whole prison knew about it. The prisoners were grief-stricken. The following day, her body was placed in a casket in her home, 3/4 mile from the prison. The second in command that took the warden's place, he was shocked to see a large crowd of the toughest, hardest looking prisoners imaginable gathered at the front gate. He came closer and he saw tears of grief and sadness. He knew how much they loved Catherine. After thinking for a moment, he made an unprecedented concession, unheard of. He said, "All right, men, you can go pay your last respects. You can go see her, but you must come back immediately afterwards." Then he opened the gate, and a parade of prisoners walked without a guard the 3/4 mile to the Law's home to stand in line to pay their final respects to Catherine. When their time was over and when it was time to check the prison count, every single prisoner had checked back in. Every single one. But that may not be the most striking part of the story. Maybe the most striking part is yet to come. It will happen one day we see a young warden's wife stand before the judgment bar of God. We also see a little old lady that helped a young boy one night. God's soul-searching eyes scan her face. He reads her very soul. And then he says, with a twinkle in his eyes, "Come in, Catherine, little old lady, come in. I welcome here because you welcomed me there. The door to my kingdom is open wide for you because of the way you treated me." "But Lord," says a surprised young mother and a little old lady, "we didn't understand. I've never even seen you." "Oh yes," he says, "yes you have. Your gracious hands once clenched mine as together our fingers brushed across bumpy pages learning to read Braille. Your benevolent hands once expressed words of comfort and courage to my eyes. because my ears could not heard. You see, Catherine, you thought those were just prisoners, but they weren't just prisoners. I was there in that prison, in the person of needy prisoners longing to be touched by the love of God, and you did that for me. She tells a little old lady, I was that little boy that came up to your house that night. And so a surprised young mother enters the kingdom along with a little old lady. You see, the parable has three surprises, and we've noticed two. The first two surprises in the parable are the surprise of the lost and the surprise of the saved. And both have to do with not realizing that they have seen Jesus. We didn't know it was you, is an exclamation of astonishment. But there is one more surprise. Only this surprise is ours. Although this may have surprised the original hearers of the parable, but it is particularly surprising to us. And the surprise is this. What we might have expected that when it comes to the bottom line, Jesus would have said something different. We might have expected that once he had laid out this parable, the broad strokes of how ready to be ready for his coming, now that he was coming to the last word, he would have emphasized the specific details of the events that preceded his coming, or he would speak with us of theology or righteousness or obedience, or that he would call us to an open confession of our faith in him, or that he would speak of grace and justification and forgiveness, but he does none of these. When it comes to the bottom line, Jesus basically asks the question, are you serious enough about your faith, about your profession, about your claim to my name that you will take all of your theology, all of your beliefs, all your ethics, and wrap them in a package that will respond to human need? In other words, do you care? Do you care enough about others to go out about meeting their simple and basic needs? Because being ready for Jesus' coming is caring for others. There's a lady several years ago wrote some pretty good things. No, they're very good things. And she says something here in Christ Object Lesson, page 61. Christ is waiting with longing and desire for the manifestation of himself in his church. When the character of Christ is perfectly reproduced in his people, then he will come to claim them as his own. That's found on page 69. Now, what does it mean to perfectly reproduce the character of Christ? Acts of the Apostles, another book she wrote, page 551. The completeness of Christian character is attained when the impulse to help and bless others springs constantly from within. Completeness is perfection. So we're not talking about being sinless, although when we care for other people, somehow our selfishness tends to dissipate, and all those sins that so easily beset us tend to kind of just melt away. Amen. Desire of Ages, another book she wrote, page 638. Those whom Christ commends in the judgment may know little of theology, but they have cherished his principles. So the bottom line, I think, has said something like this in a poem that I learned some time ago. It was battered and torn, and the auctioneer, with a voice, wait a minute. It was battered and torn, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding but folks, he cried, who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar? Now two, only two? $2, and who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three. But no, from the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. He wiped the dust from the old violin and he tightened all of its strings. And he played a melody pure and sweet, as sweet as an angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, what am I bid for the old violin? And he held it up with a bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? 3,000 once, 3,000 twice, going and gone, said he. The crowd cheered, but some of them wept. We do not quite understand. What changed its worth? The man replied, 'twas the touch of the master's hand. So many a man with life out of tune and battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once, he's going twice, he's going and he's almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. Would you please listen to the words of this song? It's a familiar one to many of us that really tells us what we as Christians should be doing today and how we reach other people.
Those that I am striving for.